I'm sitting here with Dr. Stephen Dilley. Is that how you pronounce Dilley?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Annie Crawford. And Dr. Dilley is a professor in Austin at St. Edward's. And Annie graduated from Houston Baptist with her master's. And so Annie and I are friends and just meeting Dr. Dilley. So why don't you guys start by just telling us a little bit of your background and then how the two of you met. And we'll start. Why don't you tell us, Annie, why don't you start us off? Tell us a little bit about your background and how you connected with Dr. Dilley.
Sure. Well, relative to our topic, faith and science, I have always been interested in the intersection of science and philosophy and faith since at least high school. You know, I grew up in Oregon where nature was gorgeous and I was always running in the woods, also brought up in a Christian family. So how those things connected fascinated me since as long as I can remember. And I took a dual credit course in genetics, trying to kind of figure out how faith and biology intersected. And when I went to Wheaton as an undergrad, I wanted to double major in physics and philosophy, again, to try and study that connection. But I realized I'm terrible at physics, so that wasn't a good idea. And I graduated with an undergrad in environmental science, kind of looking at science on an ecological level. And then I've been homeschooling my girls and learning along with them. And now that they were older, it was time for me to go back to the academy and kind of get some more formal training in. So that's why I was at HBU. And I know Steve through church, Christ Church here in Austin. You know, it's a church that is fairly intellectually engaged in their faith. And so there's a lot of people like Steve who are intelligent believers and who are doing good work in the church. So that's how I know Steve.
Okay.
Yeah, background-wise, it's roughly parallel with Annie in a way. I grew up in Alaska, which is a place of stunning beauty. So the outdoors, nature, it just came really second nature, and I got hooked on philosophy as a freshman. Came in as a lit student, and
did
then
you?
I realized I didn't really have the passion for literature that I thought I should have. At the same time, I got hooked on philosophy, and really my two loves in philosophy of religion and philosophy of science. And so the science and religion dialogue is a kind of natural outworking of those interests. So my dissertation was on analyzing certain episodes in the history of science and religion interaction. And it's been my primary area of interest since then. So,
yes, and
it's great stuff.
I should have told you I did my master's thesis on the use of teleological language in biology, and Dr. Dilley was a reader on my thesis, so we've had the chance to work together on this kind of topic.
Right. And just for clarification for people who maybe don't know what teleological language is, so it's the sort of the fine-tuning of the universe.
Yeah, good question. So telos means end or purpose or goal. So teleology is looking at where there is a purpose in the world, which is essential to biology, right? We look at life forms and we see that they're made to do things. A heart is made to pump blood and that sort of thing. So my thesis was looking at how biology just can't help but use teleological language.
Right.
Even when, you know, scientists are tending to want to move away from Aristotelian ideas in teleology, those biologists, they're just still addicted to it.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's interesting is both of you are very interested in the field of science, which it's odd that for some reason it feels like faith and science seem to be at odds or in the culture. That's the message. And I had the privilege to read some. I know you guys just prepared for the Mind Matters conference, and we'll talk some about that too. But I had the privilege to kind of read through some of the ideas that you were going to discuss. And one of the things that you wrote, Annie, is that faith is sometimes seen as the opposite of reason and religion being the opposite of science, or at least that's a message our culture kind of puts out there. So why is that? Why is there a message in our culture that sees science and religion at odds with each other?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. You know, this came up last night in our talk that we got to do together a little more than I realized. The importance of history. So to answer that question, you know, ideas don't exist in a vacuum. Ideas always have a context. And so we really need to remember that. And when we come across an idea like that, that faith and science are opposite, in order to understand it, we need to look, we need to know history. We need to know where ideas come from. We need to know their context. And so to answer that, you kind of need to dive into the history of science and see how science developed. And last night we talked about, you really see that idea coming into prominence in the 19th century. So in the scientific revolution occurred, that turn happened in the 16th and 17th century. And it was really led by men like Copernicus and Kepler and Galileo and Newton and these men who were devout Christians who were searching the book of nature because they believed that there was a God of order, a personal God of order, who had created an order that they could understand. And so the scientific revolution was led mostly by, you know, Christian thinkers. But once that revolution occurred and scientific inquiry is really established and it's on its way in the 18th century, 19th century, you have atheists and social philosophers who perceived science as a way that they could get powerful truth, right? Science was growing and creating all this technological advancement. You could see the power of science. And you didn't have to, when science was at work, make a direct reference to God or religion. It could kind of function on its own. And so you have these philosophers in the Enlightenment, Hobbes, Voltaire, Rousseau, looking at science as this way of knowing truth without God. And Rodney Stark, the Baylor historian, he says that these, you know, Enlightenment philosophers really wrapped themselves up in the garb of science in order to condemn religion in general. And so that's where you really see this idea starting. And they began the myth of kind of the Christian Dark Ages, which it's interesting in researching for our talk, realizing that, you know, even secular historians are willing to acknowledge now that the idea of a Dark Ages really isn't a fair characterization of the Middle Ages at all. But it was begun by Rousseau and Hobbes because they wanted to sort of create a new narrative that would free scientific inquiry and the pursuit of truth from any religious baggage. And so you see that kind of take off with their writings, and then even more so with the controversy over Darwin and kind of the PR campaign that Thomas Henry Huxley, Darwin's bulldog, sort of ran in order to use Darwin's theory as an impetus to take this myth even further. So that's kind of where it comes from. And it's just grown until this point. But what is exciting to me and encouraging is again, as I said, you have secular historians who are, you know, the discipline of history has grown a lot in the last 50 years. And there's been some good work done to improve historical inquiry. In some ways, postmodernism has brought that along, this idea that, you know, we really need to understand people's narratives from their own perspective. It's actually helped revive respect for the Middle Ages. And you see that narrative kind of being challenged more and more on a broad level. But I think the damage that it did to culture kind of on a popular level is sort of already there and still present.
Right. That's interesting because
you think answer to where that.
Yeah, no, that's a great answer. And you know, typically when you hear that word postmodern, you immediately start thinking about relative perspective, and that usually seems a negative. But in this sense, maybe it helps to understand that we may not have all the answers to the Middle Ages that we thought we had, or the Dark Ages we thought we had, or that people sometimes label it to be. And you hear, I do resonate with what you're saying, because you hear that a lot. Science says this, you know, in conversation with believers and non-believers, it's in God. People that don't believe in God typically say, yeah, how could you argue with science, though? Science says something. And I think it was Frank Turek that said, science doesn't say anything, scientists do, right? And so we look at the evidence, and then we try to decipher the best we can what that evidence is telling us. And I think that's where people get misled, is, you know, people kind of want to spin that evidence how they may or how they would like to. And what's unique too is we're finding out more and more that some of the things we thought were scientific fact are not. you know, that's kind of the price you pay with science sometimes is, you know, we're working on hypotheses and theories, and sometimes we find out later on that we were incorrect about something. So I think that's important to keep in mind. And you mentioned Thomas Huxley, and you mentioned a lot of the new atheists, which have sort of, to use your word, bulldog this message, you know, into our culture. And so that leads me to another question, and you kind of hit on this already, and Steve, maybe you can add to this. You say, Annie, in some of your notes for the conference that there's not really a war between science and faith. The battle is between two philosophies, atheism and theism, right? So I'll start with you. I'll let you jump in here, Steve. Are there any defeaters that could disprove theism? Is there any argument that could come forth that would disprove absolutely there cannot be a God if this is true?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I'd be a little uncomfortable with the language of disproof. Mm-hmm. Disproving theism, disproving atheism, and fill in the blank. Mm-hmm. Depending on what we mean by disprove or prove, if we mean it in the sense of a deduction from mathematically rigorous axioms, then it'd be presumably pretty hard to disprove a lot of what we think we justifiably believe in general. So maybe one way to think about it is there good evidence, or more generally, could there be good evidence against theism or against atheism? And I think in principle, the answer is yes. So take the problem of evil, for example. Mm-hmm. Roughly speaking, if God is all good, all knowing, and all powerful, why is there what seemed to be unnecessary evils and suffering? That's one way of thinking about the problem of evil. If one can show that, in fact, God has these good qualities, and those good qualities entail that there shouldn't be any suffering, unnecessary suffering. And number two, if one can show, yes, there are actual cases of genuinely unnecessary suffering, then I think one can at least have a thoughtful argument that would run strongly contrary to the legitimacy of belief in a traditional monotheistic God. So there's a lot more to say about whether the argument is strong. But in principle, is theism falsifiable? Absolutely. Suppose archaeologists find the bones of Jesus.
Right.
Fill in the blank, right?
Right.
And is atheism falsifiable? In principle, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's just the flip side of the same arguments, really, right? Suppose instead of, suppose we do have good reasons or a good way to grapple with evil and suffering. And then we look at the other side of the coin and we see complexity and beauty that is simply unaccounted for by all known natural processes, but that we know comes from mind, intelligence, logos. Right. Then in principle, we have strong reasons moving in quite the opposite direction of atheism. So I think both atheists and theists in their own best interest should stand up and say, yes, my views are eminently testable. The reason I believe them is because I've run these tests, and I think I have good grounds for them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you don't typically hear that you know, there's sort of a lot of language back and forth between theists and atheists, but we don't really know if there's, you know, absolutely something that you hear that a lot, that evolution disproves God, or, you know, but it's hard to pin down that argument that's been made to disprove or prove. And I think you pointed out, rightfully so, that word disprove is probably not the best word to even use, because it's a deductionist argument, and those are just not the best arguments to make. So I think that's where we find ourselves, is we look at a lot of the same evidence, and yet we interpret it differently at times. And I just think there's overwhelmingly evidence out there, especially teleological evidence, as you pointed out, that demonstrates that a mind produces organization and order, and that's what we see in the world. So, you know, of course, there's different ways an atheist would read that, but, you know, that's sort of what we have when we look at the evidence. We have two different philosophies at war, and two different perspectives sort of at war with each other.
Can I make one additional comment along those lines, Clark?
Sure.
I notice sometimes when I teach undergraduates, certainly not all, but a fair number, and I go over different worldviews, theism, deism, naturalism. When I teach about the naturalistic worldview, naturally enough, I try to present it sympathetically. Mm-hmm. So I talk about science a lot. But what's fascinating is a fair number of my students are convinced that science dovetails beautifully with a naturalistic worldview. But then if I press them at all, so what scientific theories exactly and how, and within a given scientific theory, evolutionary theory or what have you, what particular lines of evidence, they almost always draw an immediate blank.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they know it's true because they've heard it a lot
in
one form or another, but they really haven't. They really don't know the arguments in any depth.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, to your point, that there is this general sense, at least among certain segments of the population, that science strongly points away from theism and towards naturalism, even by folks who really haven't studied it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think it goes back to some of the points that Annie made in the beginning of our discussion that you know, it's sort of become a religion of its own. The new atheists that say, oh, well, science says this, or brand that into our culture where a lot of people have bought into the idea that there's just science and there's religion and you can't reconcile the two and they're irredeemable enemies, and it's not necessarily the case. But when you press in on that, it's hard to get good reasons why that philosophy is so built into our culture, or that mentality is so built into our culture. We kind of covered this, so I'll move forward. But we're talking about ways to kind of reconcile science and religion, if that's the right word. That might not be the right word for it. But Steve, this may take a minute for you to work through, but can you talk a little bit about what compartmentalism is, sort of the idea that science and religion don't overlap at all, versus other theories like complementary theory, where they interpret the same reality, maybe from different perspectives. And then, of course, concord theory, where sometimes science and religion make claims about the same topic at the same level. These theories or these ideas, I know you've done a lot of work on this, but what is the relationship between science and religion? What's the proper relationship, from your perspective, of course, but what's the proper way to view the relationship between science and religion?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it does take a little bit to unpack. So I would say briefly, as you say, a number of theories, a number of models of the proper relationship. One we've talked about, the conflict model. The two are at odds, mm-hmm. particularly theistic claims or Christian theistic claims and the deliverances of science. The compartmental model was championed by the late great Stephen Jay Gould at Harvard, a historian and a scientist at Harvard. Most fully in his book, Rocks of Ages, clever title, and on his view, sometimes called NOMA, mm-hmm. non-overlapping magisterial authority, religion has its authority, its domain, it's the realm of purpose, meaning, values, significance, and then science has a completely different realm that never touches the religious realm. That's the realm of physical facts, that which is empirical, measurable, identifiable and so on, visually identifiable and so on. So that's Gould's view, a compartmentalist view.
Okay.
The complementarity view, which is probably the most popular view, I would say, if I had to guess, among Christians who are scientists. A lot of, say, evolutionary creationists or theistic evolutionists hold this view. And the view is sometimes, unlike the compartmental model, science and religion can really address the same thing, the same natural phenomenon, but they do so at levels that never conflict, never, as it were, provide evidence for the other, but are always at complementary levels. So by way of an example, if we were to view a sunset, a scientist who might be standing with us can describe why it is we see red and orange colored light, why we don't see much in the way of blue and green light. It gets scattered as the light passes through the atmosphere. And a theologian who might be standing with us can say, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Those are complementary accounts. They're not conflicting at all. And on the complementarity view, to understand the natural world, you need both the empirical data and you need also the kind of theological reflection on it. Mm-hmm. But the key element, at least for our purposes of complementarity, is the physical data itself don't give evidence, concrete empirical evidence for religious claims. Those are a different level of interpretation. I don't know if you can see my hands. I'm sure it's super helpful.
The hand motions are helpful.
The hand motions, yes, thank you, yes. By contrast, the Concord model also acknowledges that some claims, some study of natural phenomena really do require scientific and a complementary theological understanding. The sunset example is fully accordant with the Concord model. But also, at times, you do have science and its particular claims and particular theistic claims, and the two can function such that the scientific claims gives positive evidence for theistic claims. So think of the fine-tuning of the universe, right? Mm-hmm. The initial conditions of the universe, the constants and the laws of nature seem to be exquisitely fine-tuned just to allow life within very narrow parameters. It looks for all the world like a highly, highly engineered system. If that fine-tuning argument is successful, presumably that really would give strong empirical evidence for the notion of design, the notion of a designer, which is, of course, strongly consonant with theism. So I think the Concord model is, for various reasons, probably the correct model of the two, since it includes some of the nice features of the other models, and it also takes scientific evidence seriously.
Right. Right. Annie, did you have something to add to that?
I was going
to
ask if I could ask Steve a question. So last night I talked about that it's important to remember that science itself has a philosophical grounding, right? That you need to have a certain worldview, a certain philosophy in order to do science. And we can talk about this more if you want to, but you know, last night I talked about you have to believe nature is real. You have to believe it's an object of study. You have to believe that it's good, it's worthy of your study. You need to believe that it's deeply knowable, not just on a fact basis, but on a theoretical basis. So that you need to have a certain philosophical worldview in order to even do science. So could a complementary model of the relationship between faith and science account for how science itself requires certain faith biases about the world, right? I can't prove that my senses work. I kind of have to trust that my senses work. I have to have a certain philosophical view to even do science. Can complementarianism account for that?
Yeah, I would say yes, it can. It can have, and there are a lot of thoughtful Christians who hold the view, who are involved in the sciences in one way or the other. I think it can, in the sense, it can give, as it were, wide purview to the realm of theology. So theology, legitimately on this model, can inspire scientific, that studying the natural world is in fact reading the book of nature that God laid out to us. It can motivate it in significant ways. It can provide philosophical underpinnings. The world is intelligible. The world is knowable to our finite minds. It's rational and orderly. All of that can have a theistic basis. But what complementarity can't say is that the actual empirical data, the scientific data, gives added plausibility to specific theistic claims. There is a creator. There is a designer.
So it really rules out the looking at empirical data as a basis for making an inference to a designing mind.
Yeah, that's a better way of putting it.
And that's the kicker. Yeah. I mean, that's where a lot of the debate.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, and I think in a way the complementarity model is very attractive in a lot of ways. It's very robust in a lot of ways. But in a sense, going back to your earlier question, at least in the scientific domain, is theism falsifiable? I think complementarians would have to say, no, the physical evidence is neutral. So when it comes to biology, many of them will accept, who are theists, who are Christians, will accept neo-Darwinism, the full-blown view, the same theory as Dawkins and Coyne. It's just the complementarians, thank God, is undergirding the process.
But there's no way to prove that.
But there's no scientific evidence for it. So they have they might have other good resources to bring to bear, their personal religious experience, say the moral argument, lots of other resources they can bring to bear. But the data itself, the scientific evidence itself, is evidentially neutral. And I don't buy it. I just don't buy it. And often, frankly, some folks who champion complementarity in biology will switch gears when you talk to them about the fine-tuning argument. They'll say, well, that's a good argument. Well, that's a Concord model, right?
But it's not as controversial.
It's not as controversial, right? Uh-huh. Yeah. There is a sense sometimes of, to be culturally respectable, Christians who are scientists need to, as it were, follow, if I can use that word, the consensus. I don't find that line of thinking very convincing, but that is the line of thinking to some extent.
Right. Well, and I think this is important to talk about because, you know, I'm not a scientist. I'm an English major. So all that literature stuff that we were talking about at the beginning is more my speed. But I've heard that said, you know, in Christian circles that, you know, God could direct the process however he sees fit. And I'm not sure, you know, necessarily how that holds up, especially theologically. There are some areas where that's hard to maintain. Just I see what they're trying to say, hear what they're trying to do there, but sometimes it gets to a point where, you know, you either believe what the Bible says or you do not. And I know that's a conversation for another day because what the Bible says is fully loaded with metaphors and with, you know, it's just a complex book. You know, it is. There's a lot of interpretation to be done. But we have to be careful, I think, not to just cater to every hypothesis that's out there, because I think there are some hypotheses that are in direct conflict with a Christian worldview. And so I think just being mindful of that is important. So you point out a good way to, I think, put that into, compartmentalize that, you know, your approach to science and religion. And I think that's important because we have to be careful on those grounds. And I think that's a good way to think about it. And the one model that we've spent a little bit of time talking about that I didn't mention is obviously the conflict model, that these two are just absolutely at war, you know, and there is no way to reconcile the two. And we talked a little bit about how the new atheists have just really adopted that mentality. And when we say the new atheists, we're talking Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Lawrence Krauss, some of these that are just the bigger names than, you know, formerly Christopher Hitchens. And I think that was ushered in to a point now where people have just really, really bought into that idea that religion and science, we shouldn't, I mean, there might be people that are confused as to why we're having this conversation right now today, you know, in the Christian community. And I'm not sure, I can't understand that necessarily, how you can get to that point where you don't think the conversation is important to have between science and faith, but there are people who feel like there's such a conflict there that cannot be reconciled. And you know, I think it's important for us to see what's the best way to address the relationship between the two. And so yeah, thank you for sharing those thoughts on that, because that's important, I think, to have a Christian some guardrails up to as to how to translate the scientific data that comes out. And there's more data every year, and I think more and more the data proves, you know, the theological claims. I think it always points back to the Creator, and we're seeing that. So this is kind of another question that's related, but you'll hear this. What Christians do is they just, if they don't know the answer, they plug God in as the solution. It's the God of the gaps approach. So I wonder if, and Annie, I'll let you start off here. Can you expound on the God of the gaps approach and how or where we may even be guilty of the God of the gaps approach?
Yeah, you know, I am going to pass this to Steve because last night as you were doing your talk, I was sitting there thinking, Steve is so brilliant on explaining God of the gaps. So You didn't know this, but Steve,
Yeah.
you have an excellent way of explaining this.
Okay.
Sure.
That I'm not going to try and imitate.
Go for it, Steve.
Well, there's a lot to say about it. I think the line of thinking is that over time, purely naturalistic hypotheses have replaced theistic hypotheses. So as the narrative goes, at one time we believed volcanoes erupted because Zeus was angry, or tsunamis happened because Poseidon got dumped, or, yeah, poor guy.
Or, he deserved it.
He deserved it, yeah. Or that we used to think that epilepsy was caused by demonic possession, but now we know more about, say, brain chemistry. So the idea is, particularly since the scientific revolution, as scientific knowledge has advanced, that is, natural causes have been understood more and more and more. All of these elements that we didn't know, these gaps in our knowledge, where we used to say God did this or Zeus did that, those have shrunk over time. Now we know how volcanoes operate. Now we know how earthquakes and tsunamis operate, how they come to be. And the idea is we have great reason to think, on the basis of all of this inductive evidence, the success of these naturalistic hypotheses and the shrinking of theistic ones, that over time there'll be less and less, perhaps in the receding future, virtually nothing for theistic hypotheses to explain. So the idea is, if you start to invoke God now, God is the best explanation of the fine-tuning. God is the best explanation of the origin of life. What you're really saying is, well, we don't really know what caused the fine-tuning. We don't really know what caused the origin of life. So God must have done it. So God of the Gaps line of thinking thinks of theistic explanations as operating like this. We don't know the cause of this phenomenon, therefore God must have done it. So that's the line of thinking, all right? And I hear this a fair amount, even from folks who...
should know better.
Yes, I wasn't going to say
I'll
that.
I'll say it for you.
There's just this sense, well, of course, as science has advanced, and I'm uncomfortable if you start talking about a designer. It just seems, quote, premature. I won't name him, but I talked to a very well-known physicist and Anglican priest, internationally known. I asked him about some design arguments, and his response was, quote, it's too early.
Oh, man.
That's God of the Gaps in the background, right?
Right.
So there's lots to say by way of reply. Here are just three things to consider. The first is, the argument is not totally without merit. It really does have to be taken seriously. But when we take it seriously, we want to look at the full panoply of history, including major origins claims, major origins events. What are the major origins events in the history of the cosmos? Where there's the origin of the universe, there's the origin of life, there's the origin of this strange phenomenon, consciousness, and in particular, there's the origin of the human mind. If you look at the history of naturalistic attempts to explain those four, they've ended in repeated failure. And there's no consensus on them today. There are various theories, but no consensus among naturalists about any theory in any of those four areas. So what you have, arguably, historically, from the pre-Socratics all the way to the present, is about 2,400 years of repeated, persistent failure of naturalistic theories in major areas of origins. That is not good inductive historical grounds to say that the gaps will shrink. They'll be filled. No, they haven't been.
Right.
Just by looking inductively, historically.
You could say that molecular genetics has made origin of life gap worse. There's way more to explain. It's much harder to explain the origin of the first cell, the more that we realize how complex it is, right? Yeah. How intricately functional it must be to even work at all. So I think not only is the problem still there, actually as our knowledge grows, it makes the problem bigger, at least for, I'll say, origin of life.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case in the origin of life in the 19th century. Darwin and some colleagues thought it wouldn't be that problematic to explain the very first nascent life.
It's just a little blob of jelly.
Yeah, undifferentiated protoplasm, as they say. But now, as Annie's saying, since the molecular revolution in the mid-20th century, it's been amazing the degree of complexity that must be explained. Mm-hmm. Bruce Alberts, right. for example, the former president of the National Academy, the most prestigious scientific body, writing a lead article in Cell about the molecular world. Mm-hmm. His article was about training the next generation of biologists, and he said they basically have to be trained as engineers, because at the molecular level, what they'll be studying are molecular machines. Mm. He's clear that's not a metaphor. They're actually machines. Mm-hmm. So there's a real sense here that the levels of complexity, the more we study, get the attempt of naturalistic theories becomes more difficult, the more complexity that we uncover. So think about this. That's the opposite trend. The God of the Gaps narrative is, as science progresses, naturalistic hypotheses increase in power. It looks like they're weakening in power the more we discover, right?
Right.
The third point is, it's precisely those areas, origin of life, origin of the universe, origin of consciousness, origin of mind, where design-based arguments are getting stronger because of the scientific data.
Mm-hmm.
And the structure of these new design arguments is not, we don't know how life came about because God did it. It's, we know what natural processes are in play. We know what chemistry can do in the early Earth atmosphere, in the early Earth, what kind of reducing atmosphere there was, whatever the cases would be. We know those conditions. We know the limits of natural causes. And we know also what minds can do.
Mm.
That minds can produce Mount Rushmores and right. Van Goghs. Minds can produce more complex. So even if one doesn't agree with these design arguments structurally, they're not God of the Gaps arguments. Mm-hmm. They're based on a critique mm-hmm. of all known natural causes, number one, mm-hmm. and then a positive sense, number two, of what minds can do, the complexity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the God of the Gaps, despite its power, is historically tenuous. It's lessening in power the more we know, and it's precisely those areas that the design arguments are becoming stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Can I give the Rosetta Stone example? Kind of layman's illustration?
Yeah.
So, you know, you find the Rosetta Stone, right? You go to the British Museum, see the Rosetta Stone, and you want to explain those marks that you see on the Rosetta Stone. Right. And so if you look at those marks and you say, oh, a human wrote this, some intelligent person wrote this, this is language, that's not an argument from ignorance of how wind and erosion could have actually done it.
Mm.
It's a positive argument from knowledge that I know that these marks have complex, specified, meaningful information, and I know from my experience in the world that the only source of meaningful information is a mind. So it's not simply an argument from my ignorance of how wind could have possibly done it. It's a positive argument from my knowledge about language and about humans, and if that's a helpful example.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sort of goes back to William Paley's, you know, the watch in the woods. You know, you find this watch, and of course I'm paraphrasing Paley, but you find this watch, it looks intricately designed. You know, it doesn't take a lot of faith to say that someone probably designed it instead of the wind and the erosion and, you know, natural forces brought this together. And, you know, I think the common denominator in what you both just said is that there's highly ordered, complex information, and that complex information, the one thing that we know that produces the most complex information is a mind. And so you've got, you know, these small, you know, the bacterial flagellum is always used as an example, is this small little thing that has a motor that's built like an engine that's designed and uniquely functions to work a certain way. And it, to me, that always points back to a designer and, more so to a mind. And that's positive evidence. A mind is positive evidence. And so I think some of the arguments that I've heard to sort of even get around that is, well, you know, this... there's not really a mind. The brain and the mind are not necessarily two different things. And there's sort of this idea that that the mind is just some immaterial. Consciousness is an illusion. I've heard people go as far as to, you know, you're talking about the origins of consciousness, of the mind, of of those things, and I've heard just the craziest ways to get around that, you know, instead of just saying we know that highly complex information and structurally ordered information, you know, DNA billions of characters long and ordered a certain way, points us back to something that would have to have intelligence, that would have to have a mind in order to, you know, to produce complex information. I mean, we just don't get random complex information. And still, there are these big gaps, even in the fossil record, the Cambrian explosion, all these things. We still have a lot of gaps out there. So there's sort of a Darwin of the gaps mentality out there sometimes. It's like we can't figure it out. We'll figure it out one day or someday. And as you said, Dr. Dilley, it's too early to know. I mean, that's some faith talk to say it's too early and science will prove this later versus just saying, hey, you know, we see this ordered information points back to a mind. I think that's a solid, you know, argument. And I think it's a scientific approach.
There's complementing that, I'd say there's two issues here. One is just what is the structure of these design arguments? Structurally, do they move from we don't know to a designer did it? And then the second issue is, are they good arguments in the sense that does the conclusion really follow? So relative to the God of the gaps objection, it just misunderstands the structure of the argument. You're quite right that they're based on the lack of powers of natural causes combined with our known powers of what minds can do. And then we get to the further question, did the argument succeed? Does the inference to design, is it really powerful? But relative to the first point, it would be bizarre to say, hey, look at that book on my desk. Don't tell me a mind did it. It's too early to say, right? We would not say that about a book or a road sign. But right, yet it's right. routinely said about other instances in, say, organic or cosmic history that are chock full of a higher, much orders of magnitude higher degree of complexity. Mm-hmm. It's too early to tell. There, I think we're departing from our common sense, and not just common sense, what we really rely on to make sense of the world in terms of what minds can do, what natural processes mm-hmm. can do mm-hmm. to make sense of the world around us, to make sense of ourselves as agents. And you're quite right that a kind of persistent denial mm-hmm. will, in a deep sense, undermine our own agency and our own self-understanding. And in a way, it's insidious to human self-awareness, a kind of persistent unwillingness to entertain the possibility of design. In a way.
I mean, in a common sense level, you can't get through a day or an hour without making design inferences. The assumption that this has meaning and someone did that.
Yeah.
Right.
That's hard to do.
It's hard to
do. Just a brief aside, is that okay? We sponsored on campus a couple of professors to come and give a paper, and it was from a deterministic point of view, right? Whether or not it was ethically okay to take intellectually performance-enhancing drugs within the matrix of determinism. And at one point, one of the professors stopped and sort of mused to herself, yeah, my paper is written from a deterministic perspective, but when I'm like out in the everyday world grocery shopping, I sure don't act like determinism is true. And then she went right back on.
Right. Right. I don't know how you can live with that framework of determinism. It's pretty amazing because we make conscious choices throughout the day, and you know, we sort of live as if we, you know, there's more to just the material world. We definitely live life as if materialism is not the be all end all of life. There's something else beyond just ourselves. So yeah, we make choices off that. Well, why don't we kind of wrap up with Christianity? Let's talk about the role between Christianity and science. And Annie, you may want to speak to this on what is it that's unique about Christianity as opposed to other world views or other world religions in particular that sort of is uniquely favorable to science. What makes Christianity favorable to science as opposed to Hinduism, Buddhism, you know, just some of the other religions that we're more familiar with, Islam?
Yeah, good question. And it was fun to talk about that last night. I kind of formulated three basic beliefs that, actually, I got this from Nancy Piercy's Soul of Science, and this was her approach that I thought was useful. And I just simplified it a bit, that there's three core beliefs that a culture needs to have in order to conduct scientific inquiry, in order for science to make sense. And those six are that nature is real. I think, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, you know, we need to believe it's an object that we can actually study. And you think that's obvious, but in Hindu culture, they consider the material world to be Maya, illusion. You know, if you believe that this stuff is ultimately unreal, it's not going to motivate serious, you know, painstaking empirical inquiry. So that's kind of the first one. And then we also need to believe that the material world is good. If you're going to spend your life studying it with great care, you need to have confidence that that's a worthy pursuit of your time, that the natural world is an object worthy of that kind of study. And you don't necessarily have that in all cultures either. You know, Platonism, Gnosticism tends to view the material world as the source of evil and chaos and disorder. And so if you see the world that way, you're not going to devote a lot of time to rationally investigating that which is fundamentally chaotic and disordered and irrational, right? So you need to see it as good and worthy. You also need to see the world as not itself divine, right? So if you see the natural world as itself the locus of deity, that the world is full of divine spirits itself, then it's going to seem kind of impious to go dissect that animal or cut down that tree and to go investigate nature. If you see nature itself as divine, then the right response is going to kind of be worship and placating the deities. And so to do science, you really need to see science as a gift, not as itself a god, right? So the Christian worldview, the creator is separate. The natural world has its own objective being that can be an object of study. And in Christianity, you see that world was given to us for our care, also for our study, and so that the Christian view harmonizes well there with you know, the view we need to have in order to scientifically investigate the world. And those are kind of the fundamental ones. Even more important, you need to see the natural world as fundamentally ordered. You need to spend your life, to dedicate your life to investigating it, to seeking a fundamental understanding of nature and the material world. You need to believe there's an order inside of it to go extract and to pull out. And you also need to see nature as knowable. And it was interesting researching for our talk last night. You know, Chinese culture in the Middle Ages was more scientifically, technologically advanced, at least in the early Middle Ages, than Christian Europe. But the Chinese never quite developed a theoretical science. It never really took off to that next level that we see later in the scientific revolution. And digging into Chinese history and thought a little bit, you see that while the Chinese see the world as ordered because they view that ordering as impersonal and inscrutable and kind of inaccessible to the human mind as other, there wasn't this confidence that they could know the order, to dig in and try and know it. Whereas the Christian doctrine of the Imago Dei, or the image of God, scripture teaches that God made us in his own image, in a sense gave us minds that are like his mind, so that the order that he put in, the rational order that he put into the world, our minds have an affinity, a kinship, so that that order would also be knowable to us. So the Christian also sees God as personal and good and loving, as a God who would want to talk to us. So then the material world becomes this space for dialogue between God and man. So that gives the scientists confidence that they can go read the book of nature, knowing that there's someone on the other side that wants to speak his truth to them through nature. And you see that confidence really within the writing of those scientists who led the scientific revolution, especially in Kepler and Newton. It was their desire to know and worship God and their confidence that the book of nature would be readable to them that really motivated their dedicating their lives to this painstaking work. You also need to view nature as contingent. We might not have time to go into that one. That's kind of a complex. I'll leave that up to you with our last 5 minutes if we want to talk about contingency or not. But I recommend Nancy Piercy's Soul of Science. She kind of digs into that. And there's a few other nuances in her book. I can recommend that to your readers if they want to learn more about that.
Okay. Yeah, readers, Nancy Piercy.
I guess listeners, we're on a podcast now, aren't we?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. No, I mean, I think you point out some just really important things to think about, too. I mean, you know, it's one thing to believe in God. It's another to be a Christian. That's a whole different step. And there's so much wrapped up into that. You briefly went over some of the things. I know we could probably talk about each of those things for, you know, a podcast for each of those things. But you mentioned some things that are unique to Christianity. And I think this conversation we've been having about the mind is so important to that as well. And you see, I think Francis Schaeffer does a good job with the facts, values split, kind of illustrating how we put a lot of emphasis on the facts, especially when it comes to scientific discovery, the empirical data. But sometimes, you know, we also live as if those values, morality, consciousness, all those things are just as real, but we don't typically, from a scientific standpoint, think of them as just as real as the empirical evidence that we can put our hands on. And yet we need those values to guide our hypotheses and to guide the way we, you know, even the act of scientific discovery itself, doing science, for lack of a better word, is a unique thing. And you mentioned this some in some of your lecture notes, that the act of doing science is something unique in itself. And just the fact that we've learned how to discover things and the desire to discover things that we've found to be beautiful or appealing or great, you know, it's all wrapped up in this mind conversation that we've had as well. So I think Christianity, you know, as a worldview, answers the question of the mind probably more than anything else. Being created in His image, having that personal relationship with our Creator, it's pretty powerful stuff there. So there's a lot there. So we'll close with this question. But what does the future look like for science and faith and having this conversation? Are we looking at a more positive conversation between science and faith? Is there more division in the future, and you know, with the creation of artificial intelligence and all these new technologies coming out, what is the relationship between science and faith there? And I'll let you start, Steve, if you don't mind, if you would start with just.
So there are probably lots to say about this question. A few things worth pointing out. There's a well-known survey in the early 20th century looking at scientists and their religious beliefs, including what kind of deity they believed in, if they believed in a deity who answered prayer. That same survey was repeated about 10 years ago. And the numbers, in terms of the percentages of scientists who believed in a deity who answered, were about the same. So some 80 years later or so, about the same. So at least at some level, in terms of the future of science with respect to theistic belief, with respect to Christian theism, maybe there's a kind of holding steady at some level. I will say, though, that some survey work of scientists in the National Academy, right? So these are the cream of the crop, at least by a certain metric, in terms of publications, prestige, and so on. You'll find higher rates of non-belief, including, say, atheism, among those scientists, particularly among biologists, in that body. So it looks like, if we're talking big picture trend, in terms of rank and file scientists, roughly the same levels of theistic belief. And then in terms of elite science, perhaps increasing, and then some of those tend to be quite vocal scientists, increasing numbers of scientists who don't have any kind of religious commitment, and sometimes vocally so. In more broadly speaking, the third area I would say is my sense is with the rise of the continued presence of, say, young earth creationism since the 1960s, with the rise of the intelligent design movement in the 90s, anecdotally, my sense is there are more and more young people, young theists, young Christians, who are interested in the sciences, who are less intimidated by secular views of Darwinian evolution, and who are more interested in pursuing science from what they regard as a robustly religious framework. So we may see the fruit of that, however you think about it, in the coming years and decades. It may be a little bit early to tell, but my guess is that trend will climb, particularly as more established scientists feel more secure in their positions and feel like they can afford professionally to put their cards on the table. I'm a Christian. Mm-hmm. I'm a scientist. Here's why. That will tend to attract graduate students of a certain type, give them a safe space. So it'll probably be a while before we see some of the fruit of that, but I think there's an uptick.
Mm-hmm. Good. Good. Mm-hmm. Annie, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, just to add a little. As you said, the rise of the intelligent design movement in the 90s, I'm excited to see. I think those arguments have become strong, and they've been well presented. Stephen Meyer is coming out with his new book soon, The Return of the God Hypothesis. I'm interested in seeing how that's received. I think that those arguments have, they're strong, they're compelling, and they're gaining more of a hearing. And I'm really excited to see what might happen if those arguments start to drive some actual scientific experimentation, if that hypothesis is used to do work and prediction, what might happen there. I think it's kind of an exciting time to watch. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, our deeper understanding of molecular biology and molecular genetics and epigenetics and spatial information, all this increase in complexity of life itself. So here's these intelligent design arguments that are being really well made. They're strong, they're compelling. Our understanding of life being more complex than ever. Mm-hmm. And then you had like in 2016, the Royal Society in London had a meeting to discuss, kind of admit and discuss that neo-Darwinian mechanisms are not adequate to answer what we see in life. They're not, that we have to rethink, we have to come up with some new theories. So the kind of combination right now of those three dynamics, I think is an exciting time to be alive, to be learning about science, to see what's gonna happen. If you have young people listening to this, it's an exciting time to go into science. Because I think there's new things afoot. And so I have no idea what that will be, but kind of looking at what's going on right now, I think it will be exciting and interesting at the very least.
Right. Well, and I think, too, just, you know, that there's, with scientific discovery and with new technologies, there's also ethical conversations to have, you know. And so I don't know where we have those ethical conversations if we're all, you know, determined and we're, you know, not conscious beings and we don't have minds. You know, I don't know how we can have those ethical conversations. But I think I do. I resonate with what both of you are saying. And, you know, it seems to be a consensus that science and faith are still very much in discussion and, you know, they work hand in hand with one another. And in the future, I think we'll see more of these conversations about the role of science and religion, and more people will be open to some of the religious conversations to have, the God hypothesis. So I'm looking forward to that in the future. Absolutely.
Yeah, and Claire, thanks for helping facilitate that kind of conversation.
Yeah.
Sure.
This came up a lot in our talk last night that you mentioned it, another person mentioned it, the need to have this conversation so that we realize, you know, there really isn't a zero-sum game total war between faith and science that's way oversimplified, and there's a lot to discuss. There's a lot to dig into. And so cultivating those conversations is really important. So thanks for doing this podcast to do that. And absolutely. I think, as I mentioned earlier, I was looking for a podcast on a similar topic and I couldn't find one. So thanks for leading the way on cultivating the conversation.
Well, I'm happy to do it. And I'm thankful that both of you came on. I think it was a really good conversation. So looking forward to sharing it and seeing, you know, what the fruits of that will be. Just before we go, is there somewhere that you two can be found, or if anyone's interested in going a little deeper, you know, I don't know if they can, you know, research, if you would offer them some platform or something, you know, whatever you guys are up to. I don't know what your future plans are, but we didn't talk much about that. But if there's anywhere where someone wants to follow up on this conversation a little further, what would you suggest? I guess we'll start with Steve, and then Annie, you tell us what you would suggest.
Oh, you know, I'm happy with people emailing me.
Yeah,
I guess so. Yeah.
It's so last decade.
Yeah, I'm happy with people showing up at my house unannounced.
Yeah.
But you won't give the address.
I won't give the address. Yeah, that's I'm cool. I'm absolutely cool with that. In terms of resources they can pick up, the science and religion field is just huge. It's gigantic. Mm. There are good books from an intelligent design perspective out there. There are good books from historians, largely secular, who are looking at particular episodes, the Galileo episode. If you want a kind of mainstream volume by standard issue, very good historians who don't have any kind of atheistic or religious axe to grind, one helpful volume is When Science and Christianity Meet. It's co-edited by David Lindberg and Ron Numbers. Mm-hmm. Lindberg has passed away now, but really eminent in the field. And it's a fair-minded treatment. It's a good treatment. Mm-hmm. There's some ferment there, I think, with some of the arguments. But it's well-done scholarship. Great intro to some of the major issues, historically.
Mm-hmm. I use Lindberg's book in my research and would recommend him as well. Very fair.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you want a bit more of an apologetic take on the history of science, recommend Rodney Stark's work. He has a book called The Glory of God, but he's a Christian doing his work a little bit more apologetically, but he's a well-respected historian and scholar as well.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, we could on and on with book recommendations.
We could. Well, I just want to thank the both of you again for just giving me, you know, some of your time. And I know you have busy schedules, but spending some time with me and talking about this. And I look forward to seeing what comes from it. So,
thanks, Clark.
Thanks again.
Appreciate it, man.
It was fun.
Yeah. You know, maybe there's some other topics out there we can do. And if you have, I just want so you guys know what my game plan is with this. I want to have more of these apologetic conversations. So it's a variety. I mean, you're talking apologetics, you've got, you know, people from all different fields. And so if you think of anybody or suggest,